Good afternoon, Flashback Twin Cities. Tom Osmond here with Thomas Shu.
That's right.
Again, we're getting used to that. It's again, thank you to the Screen Actors Guild of America for allowing you to use your own name again.
Well, I may be doing this undercover. We're not sure yet.
Yeah, well, we'll cross our fingers. New time, 1 o'clock. How does it feel in there at 1 o'clock? It's bright out.
It's weird. I told you, I woke up this morning at 9 o'clock, looked at my clock and said, oh, the show's over already.
Right. It's my fear. Ooh. I have every Saturday morning, actually. I wake up and the show's already over with. It's great to be here at 1 o'clock, our news time slot, and we're going to be, Chris, we have a great guest. Last week, he was a mystery guest because we did not have this confirmed. We were in tough negotiations all week, but we have Mike Binkley on today to talk about his days at Channel 5 and working at Channel 4 and the career before, during, and future. It's been a week of news. A couple of things I pulled out here. Big monumental birthday this week, and this turned 40. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Turned 40.
Turned 40.
No, I don't know.
April 3rd, 1973. Celebrate, and this is from Vanity Fair. Celebrate, get it? Okay. The 40th anniversary of mobile phone calls.
That's incredibly corny. I like it.
On April 3rd, 1973, from a Manhattan street corner, 6th Avenue between 53rd and 54th, we might get the exact location here, Motorola's Martin Cooper placed the world's first mobile phone call. To his rival, no less, Cooper called Joe Engel from Bell Systems to tell him that the race to perfect cellular tech was over. Motorola had done it first. Cooper's exact words on the call weren't recorded the way Samuel Morse's first telegraph message was, quote, what hath God wrought, or Alexander Graham Bell's first phone call, Watson, come here, I want to see you. He reportedly said something like, I'm ringing you just to see if my call sounds good at your end.
Those are not exactly inspiring words.
It's, you take innovation and corporate raiders and you put them into the streets of Manhattan. This is what happens.
Well, I still would have liked it if they just said, oi, oi, like they originally wanted it to be greeting on the phone.
Ahoy, ahoy.
Ahoy, ahoy.
Ahoy, ahoy. Right. There might be some people might remember that, that controversy, hello or ahoy, ahoy. Or if you watch The Simpsons, you might know that.
That's how I know. That's
too.
My education.
In fact, cell phones really weren't mainstream until probably about the early 2000s, but I found a video I want to play here. This is a news story from a outlet in Buffalo, New York, in 1986, talking about these new finagled cell phones. They look like, in the video, like two-pound bricks. And let's just hear a little bit about the cell phone technology of 1986.
It's a cross between a beeper and a car phone. It's a pocket cellular telephone, which Walker Telecommunications has recently introduced to the market.
Cellular really grew up in the need for people to communicate on the move, and basically this tied one to a vehicle. We really took a look at it and decided that there wasn't much sense to limiting that only to vehicular travel. So we set out to design and develop the world's smallest portable pocket cellular telephone.
There are only three portable phones available. The one on the left is put out by Motorola, the one on the right by General Electric. Walker's phone sells for almost $3,300 retail. The others are comparable at plus or minus $100.
We have, I think, a more fully featured product. We have such things as 99-number alphanumeric storage. We are 15 ounces, where the nearest competitor is probably over 2 pounds. We are much more convenient. We feel we can carry our product around in the breast coat pocket, whereas the rest require either a clip on the belt or a briefcase to carry the unit around.
The phone is a conglomerate of technologies from Switzerland, Japan, Holland, and the U.S. Walker Corporation estimates that the consumer price will drop to about $2,000 in 18 months or so from now. But at present, the demand is there.
This will run the gamut from...
Well, I hope that the price drops down to $2,000 next 18 months.
I like this thing. What is this magic brick?
People,
this magic device.
People need to talk to one another all the time. And the supermarket line, they need to talk to each other when they're crossing the street, when they're driving.
Oh, absolutely mandatory while you're driving. Don't you try and take that away from me.
In 1986, $3,300 for the cell phone. In 2012, $2013, $6,800. So take a loan out, buy your cell phone, and then and call everyone nonstop. This is a commercial that was put out by Radio Shack, selling, again, these cell phones. And the price points, I think, are quite interesting.
Can I try it first, Mom?
Please.
All right.
A new generation of affordable cellular phones at an incredible price breakthrough from Radio Shack, the technology store.
Hi, Daddy, it's me.
And now there's a totally portable phone at a price we dare the competition to beat.
Yes, we can. Okay, be there soon.
Radio Shack, the first name in cellular telephone technology.
There you go. It's inspiring.
I want one right now.
You know what? I'll sell you one for $2,000. I will do that for you.
Somehow I feel like you're taking advantage of me. Well, how much was the Walkman that you talked about a few weeks ago?
The first Walkman? I think the first Walkman we found out was about $200, $300 price point, I think, when it first came out. And I think that we did the inflation calculator, and I think it was $500.
$500 or so?
We'll check the tapes and make sure I'm providing accurate information. Another sad event this week. So we had the monumental cell phone anniversary. Roger Ebert passed away, unfortunately, after a long battle with cancer. And this is from CNN. It was on the pages of newspapers and in the coveted aisle seat on televisions at the movies that the world met Roger Ebert, the passionate lover and sometimes combative critic of film who virtually defined cinema critique for a generation. But in his final years, when cancer had robbed him of his jawbone and whittled away his once ample frame, it was social media, particularly Twitter, that let Ebert not only keep talking, but also interact with his fans, foes, and more freely and personally than ever. This is a quote from Roger Ebert. "Twitter, for me, performs a function of running conversation," Ebert wrote in June 2010, about 8 months after he signed up for the site and 5 years after losing his vocal cords and part of his lower jaw to thyroid and salivary gland cancer. "For someone who cannot speak, it allows a way to unload my zingers and one-liners." Very sad that I'll be missing Roger Ebert's thumbs up. Siskel and Ebert are both gone. It's hard to believe, huh?
It really is, actually. I grew up with them, and, you know, I just enjoyed every single time I got to see them on TV. It wasn't often, but I loved it.
They were on Channel 5 for a long time. I think they were on Channel 9 before that here locally. And I always liked, when I liked a movie that Siskel and Ebert did like, I thought that I was intelligent. I thought that I was, thinking the same ways as these big Chicago film critics. Let's just play a commercial from their first show. This is a 1982 commercial for the new Siskel and Ebert at the Movies.
They should have watched our show. They should our show. Maybe you should watch our show. I'm Gene Siskel, film critic of the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Roger Ebert, film critic of the Chicago Sun-Times. Our full-time job is going to the movies.
So join us this fall for At the Movies, the movie review program.
Saturday nights at 6:30 here on Channel 9.
There you go.
I mostly enjoyed their arguing. Those moments where you don't know if they're actually fighting, if it's a show.
That did happen once in a while.
Fairly often.
There's a few, if you go to YouTube, you can just YouTube Siskel and Ebert, and there are some of the best. There was a video I was going to play today that Siskel and Ebert were doing outtakes from a commercial they were doing. The tone might not have been appropriate for this week and some of the language we had to use our sensory squad for, but I encourage you to go to YouTube and type in Siskel and Ebert. There's some good stuff there. This is Flashback Twin Cities, and our guest today will be Mike Binkley. Let's take a break, and we will come back. Again, the email is flashback@klbradio.com. Twitter at TC Media Now, or check us out at tcmedianow.com for some of the videos we'll be talking about today. Let's take a break. We'll be back with Mike Binkley. Flashback Twin Cities, this is Tom Osman, and with me, Mike Binkley at WCCO TV, Channel 4. Mike,
hey,
good
Tom.
Afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. This is our first show, 1 o'clock, and you don't do a lot of media after 12:30 too much, so this is...
I have a marathon day. 12:30 comes, and yeah, I'm usually done for the day. But no, it's great to be here in Stillwater with you too.
No, it's a great day. You know, always good to go to Stillwater, but especially on a nice. Is it bright outside still? I haven't.
It's been getting better.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. The little spot I park is there's still ice mountain there, but that'll be going away. So now here's a question I've always wondered: people that anchor the news as early in the morning as you do, what time do you go to bed at night to get to do that 4 o'clock show?
I go to bed around 5:15 at night.
Okay,
hoping
right.
to fall asleep by about 5:30 because I get up at 1:30.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I can't fall asleep till about 6. But yeah,
is that tough? Is that tough to go to bed when the world is still running and there's
It's easier in the wintertime when the sun goes down earlier mm-hmm. than it is in the summertime when it stays up later. But when you do that schedule regularly, you kind of just change your life around and you get in the habit of doing that. I feel sorry for the people who have to fill in every now and then. And
right,
they come
right.
in and that's really, you know, freakish to them. But, you know, it's just my life.
Mm-hmm. And you've done mornings for how many years now?
Well, it was 7 years at KSTP and then it's been a little more than 4 years at WCCO now.
Right, right. And you've been in the Twin Cities since 1986. Tell me briefly, before you came, you worked in Kansas and you worked in Cincinnati.
Cincinnati, yep.
And where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Topeka, Kansas. So
okay.
I got my first job in my hometown, you know, so my family and my friends, who are very forgiving,
mm-hmm.
you know, were very thrilled to see me on TV. But yeah, I worked there about a year before I jumped to Cincinnati, and I worked there 5 years.
So you weren't satisfied being your hometown. You wanted to go to the big, the bigger lights, the bigger city.
Yeah, well, Topeka, Kansas. I mean, it's a nice place to grow up, but yeah, I had bigger plans.
Sure. And so you got a job at KSUP, and did you send some tapes out, and then Channel 5 liked what they saw, or how were you focusing on Minneapolis?
I wasn't, actually. In this business, it's oftentimes who you know more than anything, and it just so happened that the former general manager for my station in Cincinnati came to KSTP, and he liked my work, you know, and so he said, you know, I guess I must have called him, and I said, my contract is up,
mm-hmm.
and I'm looking to get out of Cincinnati. He goes, okay, I'll get you in touch with the news director.
Came to KSTP in, was it September of 86?
September of 86, yeah.
The General Assignment Reporter.
Yep.
And you were fortunate enough, but within about a year, to be anchoring weekends.
Right. It was a brief stint. They had an opening, and they put me on there, and it was fun. I was on there for 9 months, and I reached the point, though, where I said, you know what, I'm solo anchoring this show. I'm doing the job of an anchor. I'm still earning a reporter's salary.
Right.
What do you think? Could I maybe get a raise? And they said, I don't know, we'll just put somebody else on there.
You know,
part of the business.
It's hard about negotiation tactics.
Yeah.
Well, solo anchoring, that's a strategy that is long gone now. No, you have to have at least two or three or four anchors at a show right now.
Right. Yeah, and I'm glad of that.
And it's actually, I find it's very rare that someone actually would say, I don't want to do this anchoring job anymore because do you find what's more challenging? Is it more challenging to be on beyond the pressure of the camera and, you know, with the audience every day, or to do the general assignment reporting stints you did?
I would say each of them have their own challenges. I kind of consider myself as a reporter who
does
an okay job,
right.
you know, on
right.
the anchor desk or whatever. But, you know, deep in my heart, I think I'm a reporter. Being a reporter, you have the challenges of the deadlines and, you know, trying to get as much information as possible before
mm-hmm.
that deadline arrives and then get it done, get it to the editor, you know, work with the photographer, you know, the logistics of getting around town and getting all the information that you need, you know, something that a newspaper reporter doesn't have to do because they
mm-hmm.
largely just sit there on the phone. So that is the pressure of being a reporter. But as far as the anchor, it's largely a popularity contest. I mean, you're trying to get people to like you, to
right,
believe
right.
you, to want to tune into you, you know, day after day. So being on, you know, especially as we are, 2.5 hours in the morning,
right.
you know, that's a challenge to be up and positive. You know, everybody's going to have bad days. But
right.
but the viewers at home don't care when you're having a bad day. You know, you still have to bring it.
That's right. No, it's amazing. I was just talking a little bit off air. The amount of hours that morning news goes on, and now even evening news, because the duopolies now and stations, you know, station companies own three or four stations in a market now.
Right.
You know, a couple of them here in town. You finish your first stint, and then you go to the second channel, and you're doing another newscast.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe niche a little bit closer to your demographic you're reaching for at the station this time, but that's a lot of news out there. And if you think about it, in 86, you know, CNN had not matured yet.
Right.
CNN was on cable. We didn't, I think it wasn't until the Gulf War that people really took to CNN as a credible news source. It was
mm-hmm.
there, and they were providing good content, but Now we look at how many, you know, commercial stations here in town, and plus we have four or five cable news stations right now. There's a lot of news out there, plus Facebook, Twitter, the newspapers online. It's a lot of news content out there.
Well, and that is what has really shrunk the budgets of news departments. We're not doing the traveling that we used to do. You know, we don't have the reach, so we do have to kind of specialize a little bit more. You know, there are good and bad things about that, but yeah, we definitely have a lot more competition than we've ever had.
Let's talk about those early days of KSDP. You come from Cincinnati and compare the Cincinnati market to the Twin Cities market. Was it, I don't know the ranking of it right now between, I think it's a little bit smaller than Minneapolis.
Yeah, Cincinnati is about the 30th largest market, okay. And Twin Cities is 15th.
Did you feel a little overwhelmed? Did you feel like, you know, did you feel like, wow, this is in the top 15 markets now? This is...
you know, a little bit. And it was so great to see Stan Turner here at the station as I was just arriving. And he and I had a chance just briefly to reminisce. But we were talking about how that time when I arrived, the mid-80s to the late 80s, we really hit the top of the wave right then. And actually, KSDP was the place to be. Stanley Hubbard, you know, with just all the pioneering in technology and satellite broadcasting that he did. It was at that moment that we were just starting to be able, as a local station, to be able to go live from anywhere, not just in the state or in the country or in the world. I think in my first few months when I arrived there, Jason Davis had just finished doing some live reports from the North Pole.
That's right.
And so we had the technology. It was invented in our backyard, and we wanted to show it off. And we had the much bigger budgets back then to travel. So if there was a big story to go somewhere, we were going to go there. We weren't just going to depend on the network. You know, and quite often we could find a Minnesota angle while we were out there. But I went on a lot of really big stories in the mid to late 80s.
We'll talk about those in a second here. Just to talk about Stanley Hubbard, a lot of... you know, there's mixed press, you know, when things happen and in business and people get mixed perceptions. But Stanley Hubbard is not in the Broadcasting Hall of Fame, you know, by accident. He innovated a lot of technology and a lot of way news is gathered in the country right now, a lot of model for satellite news gathering. And Dennis Felgen has a great story when he was called in the office. And this is Stanley P. Hubbard comes into the offices. This thing, I want this. And he looks at the magazine. It's a Doppler radar. It had not been invented yet. And he said, well, I'd love to buy one, but it's not invented yet. And within about a year, a truck rolled up to KSDP Studios with the first Doppler radar.
Right.
6 months later, a tornado flew right over the station, though, and the Doppler didn't catch it. But that's well, it's bound to happen sometimes.
Yeah, seriously. But no, he's definitely a visionary. He was always, you know, wonderful to me. I have the highest respect for Stanley Hubbard.
This is Flashback Twin Cities. My guest is Mike Binkley. I'm going to play a clip here. This is from that 9 months of news anchoring, and this is a great story because the intro of the story kind of goes into some of the news events of the last few weeks here.
You're watching KSTP-TV, Minnesota's News Channel 5. Live from Minnesota's News Channel, KSTP Channel 5, Mike Binkley, Karen Falloon, and Mark Stevens bring you Eyewitness News.
More than 57,000 Minnesota Vikings fans packed the Metrodome in downtown Minneapolis today, a sellout crowd. But the Vikings aren't the only team that wants to play before Minnesota's enthusiastic crowds. Good evening, everyone. Minnesota and its Metrodome have a new reputation thanks to the World Series. Sports executives are finding they like what they see in the state, the fans, the dome, and the cities. As Pat Mylan reports, Governor Perpich is taking aggressive action now to land championship events in Minnesota.
The Metrodome,
the
stadium of the future.
Yeah, really.
Today.
I guess that way, you know, that was within a couple of months of the World Series Championship of 1991, or 87.
87,
yeah, that was
right.
The first World Series Championship. And, people were still kind of uneasy, I think. But then when they saw the hanky-waving fans, we really did put on a good show for the national audience.
You know, if the Strikers would have got a national championship, that stadium would have been cemented forever.
Yeah.
No, it's there's a lot of great dome stories. There's one, and you talk about this in the story. If you go to tcmedianow.com, that entire news broadcast actually is online. We were just experiencing the first dome collapse a few years before,
right?
And, flash forward 23 years, we had our second dome collapse.
Yeah.
And won't even talk about the teams that played in the stadium. They might have had a few collapses too. But let's that first year, 86-87, there were some big events. The Twins won the World Series.
Yeah.
You were there the day they won the World Series. You were reporting live from the streets of Minneapolis.
Yeah, outside with the mad fan. I mean, there were people who came down just to be in that area of the dome. I think some of them were watching the game at Hubert's. You know, others were just kind of camped out with their radios, and they just wanted to be part of the party because, you know, Minnesota sports. I mean, how many championships can we celebrate?
Well, there's not very many.
There haven't been that many. So I remember that they were mostly well-behaved, but I do remember I was doing a stand-up after the 87 World Series championship, and there was a man in a gorilla suit that was grabbing my tie. And that little clip, I need to find that, Tom. I'm still looking through my stash of tapes.
I like a challenge.
Yeah.
We're going to find it.
That made it onto CNN. I had people from, you know, other parts of the country saying, I just saw a gorilla pulling your tie on outside the Metrodome.
You give me a clip, give me a challenge, I'll find it.
All right.
We'll find that. Okay, so 651-275-1220. If you have the clip of Mike Binkley's tie being grabbed by a man in a gorilla suit, check your 1987 World Series tapes. Give us a call. That's great. And then a few months prior to that, the Superstorm, which just turned 25 years old this past year.
Yeah. That was, Tom, I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to go through this big box of old VHS tapes. But that was one, we had a Twin Cities Live program where we were all kind of looking back on this big year of 1987. And it's helping me remember some of these, you know, I have vivid memories of, others not so much. But, you know, there's a point where I'm talking about how I got called in the middle of the night.
And we're all public service here. Why don't we just play a clip of that, that Twin Cities Live show?
It's fun being a news reporter, isn't it? Right in the midst
Go Twins,
of
yeah.
Speaking of being in the midst of things, Mike, because I you and Kevin both covered the storm along with some of the other reporters, the great superstorm that we had.
Right.
Here you have a situation where a storm is going on, and all the media outlets are telling everyone, stay at home, don't go outside, it's very dangerous, don't walk in the water, a power line could fall into it, you could get electrocuted. And where do we find Mike and Kevin but standing out in the middle of Highway 12 with water up to here? I mean, what's it like being in the midst of something like
that? Well, she had it the worst. But, yeah, me and my photographer were just talking about that the other day. When we were going on the air telling people, take cover, stay in your basements, you know, take all precautions, don't go out unless it's absolutely necessary, we're the ones who are out there.
Let's go!
Yeah, exactly. On the day of the superstorm, that was my day off, and I was called in on my day off. And there you see some of the flooding victims coming out of their apartments. That was the worst rain that I have ever experienced in my life, you know, and I'm driving in from Richfield, 20 miles away, and, you know, concerned about whether I'm going to make it in. And as it turned out later on, I ended up being there the entire night, and as it turned out, I went home the next day and found out that the garage in my apartment complex had been completely flooded out. You know, all the cars in there were completely totaled. So that was one time when I really said thank you to my assignment editor for calling me in on my day off.
I remember the shot.
I think that in Minnesota we like reporting on tornadoes, we like reporting on severe weather because it's such a part of what we talk about in the summer.
It is. There's a kind of a backstory with me too. Growing up in Kansas, you know, kind of tornado alley. My home was hit by a tornado in 1966.
Wow.
And crazy enough, we did not have a basement in our home in Kansas, so we had to go across the street to these brick apartments. And you know, sure enough, that, you know, the sound of the train that everybody always describes, and the bricks flying in through the window wells, and the screaming people, and then walking out and not recognizing my neighborhood when we walked out. So you know, that had haunted me for quite a while. And I've been out, you know, chasing tornadoes on storm coverage before, where some of that kind of comes back to me. I think I've mostly gotten past it now. I find it kind of exciting, but yes, the storm coverage, you know, the reporters do put themselves in danger sometimes. You try not to, but, you know, you got to get the story.
Was that the most dangerous story you've done, do you think?
That superstorm, the most dangerous storm? I'm trying to think. I know there have been times when hailstones have been pounding our car when we've been out. Yeah, I guess I would have to say so. I know some other reporters have been, you know, in much more precarious positions than I was on that night of the superstorm. But yeah, it was quite dangerous.
There's some great video on tcmedianow.com, and there's about three or four reporters with large cameras, as they were in the day, wires coming into the water, hot microphones. You know, it's amazing we didn't have stories the next day on reporters being fried, you know, by their own equipment the
right.
next day.
Which, it happens. I mean, you're out there with a live truck, and to get the signal back to the station, you put up this large mast, mm-hmm. you know, which basically can become a lightning rod if you're there in the middle of a storm.
Right. So you did so Superstorm and the Twins, and you took a step back from anchoring for a while,
yeah.
but then you went back to it. Tell me a little bit about that. You took a few years back in the reporting world and then
yeah.
brought you back to do weekend anchoring.
Well, and really that was, my wife and I were just talking about, there was about the time that that we got married, 1993, I broke my foot. And so I realized I wasn't going to be much, I wasn't going to be very mobile anymore. And I don't know whether this played a part in it or not, but the timing just seemed right that they put me on the weekend anchor desk. And so 2 days a week, I was just kind of sitting there doing my job. But then ultimately, about 7 years later, it must have been around 99 or 2000, then I was put on the morning anchor desk. And so that was 5 days a week of anchoring.
So tell me a little about the difference between doing the morning news and the weekend news and what, you know, that transition.
I definitely like the morning news better because it's a more relaxed feel, but it does take a while because all my life I had kind of been the big J journalist, you know, mm-hmm, the top mm-hmm. story reporter and things like that. And here I am on the morning show, and they're wanting me to be more Mr. Personality.
You don't rough to get and be with you. You have to be.
See, when you work with Rusty, that'll loosen you up a little bit. But it took me a while to not take myself so seriously. Mm-hmm. But that's the good thing about being on a morning show. I mean, you've got so much time to fill. But you also realize that people in their homes, they're just waking up and they don't want, you know, they don't want their morning filled with fires and murders and mm-hmm, things. I mean, you've got to report the news, but they also want some lighter things that can help them get ready for the day. We realize they're kind of getting the kids off to school, getting breakfast made, that sort of thing. So we do have, you know, we have a lot more fun on a morning show than you would on a traditional newscast weekday or weekend.
Is there a fine line where you can be too optimistic for the viewer at home? Like you said, they're just waking up. Some people don't respond so well to bright sunshine.
Be too cheery. Yeah. In the morning, you know, yeah, they haven't had their coffee yet, and here you are, Mr. Sunshine. I don't know. I guess we haven't heard too much of that. Every day we have this we have a morning show Facebook page where we kind of give a little teaser of here's what's coming up on the show today. And, you know, sometimes we do like to put a lot of the light stuff, a lot of the fun stuff that we're doing there, and we'll see people will respond to that, and they'll say, what about news? You know, fluff. Well, you know, this isn't a complete lineup of everything we have in the show. These are just some of the fun things that you might want to tune in for. But, yeah, we try and strike that balance. We don't want to be too light, you know, but we also don't want to be too serious either.
Everyone's a critic.
Seriously.
I imagine that, and we were talking about Roger Ebert being able to connect with his fans on Twitter. There's got to be a lot more personal connection now you can have with your audience now mm-hmm. through Twitter and through Facebook and through mm-hmm. these other means. In I'm gonna call them the old days, but if you know years ago, did you get some phone calls and letters, and now that's transitioned to emails and transitioned to Facebook comments.
Yeah. I think we're a lot more accessible now than we used to be. I remember in the early days of email, you know, I'd give out my email address, and actually there would be people like, is this okay that I have this? Well, yeah, I mean, this is how you're going to get in touch with me now. But yeah, as far as the social media, it is very time consuming, as anybody knows who's, you know, part of Facebook or Twitter, but it really has become part of our job.
Mm-hmm.
Our marketing budgets aren't what they used to be, so this is free marketing for us. This, you know, we know how often people check their Facebook pages or their Twitter pages, and this is just kind of our chance to say, hey, you know, we're here. You know, this is what we're doing. Oh, look how much fun we're having. You know, look, this is why you should watch us. This is why you should listen to us. So, yeah, we take advantage of that.
And you've anchored with Angela Davis in two different stations,
right?
In two different stints now.
Yeah.
So how many years together with Angela Davis now?
I would say, well, let me see, it was 6 years at KSTP. Oh, actually, my wife is in the studio. See, we met at KSTP. 15 years total? I don't think that's right. Because it's been 4.5 years at WCCO, and we work together on the mornings and weekends. Well, I know that Angela Davis is fond of saying that she's known me longer than she's known her husband. And I know they've been married for quite some time. So, yeah, it may have been as long as 15 years.
Well, you have to have a work spouse and a home spouse. That's great.
Yeah, she's my work wife.
So, a question I'm sure you've got frequently is what made you leave KSTP? You were number one for quite a bit of time when you were at mornings, which is not a normal for a KSP news show in the latter half of the 1990s.
It, you know, we got to be number one in the ratings. There were a couple of times that we were number one in the demos, which is what everybody's after, the 25 to 54. I had been there. It was one of those instances where you reach a milestone and you start to wonder, is this... How much longer am I going to do this? So I had been 20 years at KSTP, so I was from 1986 to 2006. So that's kind of a nice round number of 20, and mm-hmm. I decided, I think I'm going to take a break. And I wasn't sure. I might have been done with the news at that point. Ultimately, after about a year or so being away from the news business, I decided I want to get back in, and I was just fortunate that WCCO came along and hired me.
It's and I'm ask this is my toughest question I'm gonna ask you in an era where people are being relieved on their own not on their own they're being forced out through budget cuts and through station consolidation. You chose to leave on your own,
right?
And we'll be real here. Occasionally there was people at Channel 5, well, in every station that did not leave on their own and was very highly publicized.
Right.
I think people would be surprised to hear that you did that. What did you think you were going to do? Like, so you took some time off. What did you want to do? What did you want to try?
Well, the thing was, people in this business, not as much anymore, but back then everybody had a one-year non-compete clause. And mm-hmm. so I knew that I would have to sit out for a year before I could go to work for any other TV station. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I actually, to be completely honest with you, I did think that I wanted to get back into the news business. At that time, it's a high-stress environment. And KSTP, as you've mentioned, they had their struggles. And,
right.
And there were a lot of people coming and going. And sometimes that gets to you. And so I think that did play a part. What I had to do in order to do that was actually plan, starting about a year in advance, we started saving money. We downsized our home. We got to the point where we knew that whether I decided to stay or whether I decided to go, that we would be able to swing it. But when I did leave, then I started my own business. It was a video legacy business where I had, it was mostly baby boomers who were hiring me. I bought a camera, I bought editing equipment, and they had me basically interview their parents mm-hmm. to tell their story in about a half hour. I mixed in photos and music and that sort of thing. So it was a really fun way for me to use my creative ability still and even reporting skills, and I learned a few new skills along the way.
My guest today is Mike Binkley of WCCO TV. This is Flashback Twin Cities. Let's take a break. We'll come back with some more stories from Mike Binkley's 25, 26-year career here in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. St. Paul. Flashback Twin Cities. I am Tom Osmond, joined by Mike Binkley of WCCO TV Channel 4. www.wcco.com. Is that the correct website?
That's it, yeah.
Okay. Or CBS Minnesota. Call it now, right?
Yeah. If you go to wcco.com, it's going to switch you to, what is it, CBS.Minnesota
right.
Local. I don't know, but they make it easy. You can just go to wcco.com.
You can see Mike every morning at, what time do we start now? 4 a.m., 5 a.m.?
4:30.
4:30 in the morning.
I was remembering a time when we went from 5:30 to 5 o'clock, and people were like, seriously, who is up at 5 o'clock in the morning to watch the news? And, of course, now we're starting at 4:30.
Right.
And there have been times that we wonder. I know some stations in other cities start at 4.
In Chicago, I think the WGN starts at 4 o'clock. I think they go until 9 o'clock. That's a few hours
a
on the air. Right.
Yeah.
I think they have to come back and do the noon show, too, I think.
Wow.
We were talking a little bit about news in the new media age. And I through history, radio and TV and movies, everything is going to be the death. The next big thing is going to be the death of the last two.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, here we are in radio. It's 2013. Radio is still here.
Yeah.
It's in a different format, obviously. Different formats, different niche. What do you think the future for TV news is going to be now that we can watch on our phones? I can pull up 25 years of video online right now. We can watch this. What's your thought on this?
Yeah, more and more of it is going online. I mean, we're kind of seeing the merger of TV and internet. I think that's kind of the next big thing. But in terms of news, I don't know whether anybody has yet figured out how it's going to work. But I mean, we're obviously doing as much as we can online. The challenge, of course, is finding a way to monetize that, to make
right,
money
right.
off of it. You know, people do get tired of seeing a commercial before every little clip that they want to watch. But, I mean, the people who are gathering the news and presenting the news need to be paid, too.
Correct.
So, I don't know. You know, I'll probably hopefully be in the business for another 5 to 10 years. And I would think that, I don't know, maybe I hope that I'll still have a place. But it's interesting, you know, because I do have students come in from the local colleges who mm-hmm. want to shadow me, and I look at them and I wonder, what is this going to be like for you? Because, you know, I left the business in 2006, and even between 2006 and 2008 when I got hired by WCCO, things had changed so dramatically in terms of just the computerization of the newsroom and going digital. That was kind of around the time that WCCO went digital, right around 2008. Mm-hmm. And everybody was, and switching to high definition.
How has your job changed? I mean, let's say about 10 years ago. 10 years ago, the internet was there. Broadband hadn't really matured yet.
Right.
There was a website for KSTP or Channel 11, but
yeah, there wasn't a lot of emphasis.
No, there was a story there. We'd go and we'd click on and be there. But how has your expectations of what you do in the morning changed due to new media? Are you expected to tweet? Are you expected to put Facebook postings out there?
Yeah, I guess we don't have direct orders to do that, and there are some people in my business who don't do that, but I think that we all see the value of it in doing it. So, like I said, it's just part of the whole marketing effort to remind people that we're here mm-hmm. and try and become, you know, the preferred brand.
Right.
But I was, in preparation for this, I was looking back to the 1986 newsroom mm-hmm. versus the 2013 newsroom.
Sure.
It, you know, when I first walked into KSDP, of course, you know, we're typing on typewriters. We're you know, putting the paper into the typewriters. The guy at the desk next to me is smoking. You know, we have no computers. We have no cell phones. You know, we have no internet, obviously. We have photographers with these really, you're talking about the big deck that they had to carry over their shoulder in addition to the camera. You know, it's just now in the 2013, we have the computers, we have access to videos on our desktop mm-hmm. from around the world, from around the country, and anyone in the newsroom can access the videos that have been shot out in the field. You know, there's just, and we can go live from anywhere. We have devices where we can be rolling down the interstate and, you know, and broadcasting live, you know, which we didn't have 5 years ago. Technology has really helped us deliver the news faster. You know, there's much more immediacy now than there used to be. You know, and in some cases that makes our job a lot easier. In some ways, it does make it tougher. The stricter deadlines. When we used to go out of town on a story, that would usually just be an overnighter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because
mm-hmm.
there's no way we can get it back to be on the air. But now, you know, we can go live from wherever we go.
Plus, you were having tapes to edit. You had to go
exactly.
to an editing room and sit with the editor and
yeah.
go through three Betacam tapes and get a 30-second or a minute package together.
Yeah.
Now I think you can do that on your phone or iPad, and the picture. It's pretty amazing. I like when you watch, you know, locally Channel 4 or even CNN, or you pick your favorite national station, how much video is used from citizen journalists now
yeah.
that people send in, or it's off YouTube, and it's got to make some of the photographers in the business a little bit worried that what they've done on their craft is almost flatlining right now, because everyone has a camera, everyone has a technology to produce some pretty good pictures out there.
Yeah, in many ways, yeah, that does help us. But I don't know that they would ever. I mean, they're not ever going to replace the news photographer.
Right.
I mean, there are skills that they have that others don't have. But it sure helps in the visual business that we're in to have all these visuals from around the world. But we've kind of learned something from the citizen journalists too. We'll send a reporter, for example, out to a fire scene, and the first thing you do ordinarily as a reporter is to start taking notes and interviewing people, but they're expected now to take a picture on their cell phone and send and email that back to the web team immediately, so you
right.
know, we can have that up on the front page of our website right away. So I mean, we have extra responsibilities that come with that.
Yeah, the term media is really broadening, I think. And I think
it is.
That these flagship news programs are going to be, you know, a part of an entire arm of, you know, social media and online media. You know, my hope, and I'm glad that DCCO does this, is seeing these full broadcasts online and be able to view them. On tcmedianow.com, a lot of these are taped off of VCRs or off of very old pneumatic machines, which there was no streaming, and
right.
It's fun to see that. Talk a little bit about, more about the early newsroom days when you came to KSTP, and besides the smoking and the typewriter, what else do you think is the biggest difference or some of the differences between that era and today?
Well, you're talking about the tapes that we had to edit on, you know, as a matter of editing individual tapes and running them to this room where they would be played, you know, sometimes scrambling at the very last minute. Any special effects that you wanted to do in any reports, I mean, that would require special time set aside back in the master control room where some mm-hmm. engineers could kind of configure some things. But now, you know, with the Final Cut that we have mm-hmm. and all our edit bays, you know, something that is edited in 30 minutes out in a live truck in the field can have dissolves and wipes if you want them, mm-hmm. That comes up on the screen. So it's, you know, in terms of the visuals, we're so far ahead of what we were even 10 years ago.
Can you imagine having to have film developed, you know, before the 10 o'clock news?
I can, because actually when I first started my first station in 1979 at WIBW in Topeka, it was still the film days there. I think others were already getting to videotape, but, you know, in Market 140, we were mm-hmm. still, we had to wait for the film to come back from the developer before we could, you know, divide it up into the A roll and the B roll. The A roll is going to be where the sound bites are, and the B roll is going to be the cover video that comes with it.
I can't even imagine that. I mean, we're so impatient now when we, you know, click on the website and it takes 10 seconds longer to load a website up than...
taking so long?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's 10 seconds of pure anger.
It is.
And then it wasn't that long ago. We were dialing up to, you know, go on AOL or CompuServe, and mm-hmm. then we'd have to wait, you know, for the busy signal to be done to, mm-hmm. before we go on whatever chat room we were in.
Right.
But I can't... The further away you are from it, and... trying to picture bringing in this film to be developed and then go through film and then splice it together for a 10 o'clock spot.
And where we were kind of on the edge of town, you know, Topeka, not a very big town, but I mean, it had to be driven a couple of miles at least mm-hmm. to the place where they processed the film. We didn't have our own film processor there, you know, which probably the bigger stations did. But yeah, there was a lot less video on our newscast back then.
Lots of hours of film, lots of hours of video that were burned probably in the process too. How many minutes of film for that 20, 30 second stand up?
Well, you know, when I was a Cub reporter, I like at a lot of stations, I was doing it all, and so I did have to go shoot film. And I remember them telling me, you know, be very, you know, conservative with the film. Don't shoot too much.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about what is your most memorable story? We talked about some of your more dangerous stories covering yeah. the flood. But what is the story if you had to say you're most proud of in your 26 years of working in Minnesota?
Well, I would say definitely the most memorable story, and I have a lot I have a top 10 or so, but I would have to say the most memorable story, because it was just so emotional, was the lift off the Space Shuttle Discovery, which was in 1988. It was 2.5 years after the Challenger right. disaster. It was the first time, and there was a Minnesota astronaut on board. I was George Pinky Nelson mm-hmm. From Wilmer. I was flown down there to be at Cape Canaveral. I was there with all the dignitaries, and you remember. I mean, the mm-hmm. Challenger mm-hmm. disaster was one of those moments in time where everybody remembers what they were doing when that happened.
We were in school, and it was at that time it was a big deal to have a color TV. We were, you know, all of us were gathered in grade school, you know, yeah. gathered to watch this because there was teachers, you know, on the Challenger.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine what the teacher, you know, I think back now, you know, in hindsight, what those teachers had have gone through in the school.
Mm-hmm.
They bring all these kids to a room to watch this, and yeah. then that happens.
Yeah, Krista McAuliffe, and there were shots mm-hmm. of her parents who were there mm-hmm. on the launch pad. But so 2.5 years later now, we're back, we're ready to go back into space, and mm-hmm. there's the anxiety of everybody right. there on the launch pad. And when it finally went off, and I'm with a group of photographers and reporters who are in one area, affiliates from Florida and, you know, others from around the world, and just looking over and seeing the tears streaming mm-hmm. down the faces of, you know, other, you know, journalists. You know, it was just so, we were all swept up in so much American pride, you know, mm-hmm. relief, and just kind of wonder at, you know, just to be that close, to feel the ground shaking, you know, and to hear the roar of the shuttle going off. It, you know, I don't know, you know, that my reports, you know, were anything special, but as far as a moment of me as a reporter being in a special place, you know, that I think is tops on my list.
Well, the fact that they were able to go down there and be part of that and be actually not just reporting it, but actually being, you know, being almost part of history with this group down there.
And that was at that time that we were talking about earlier, where we had the new technology, we had the travel budgets, we mm-hmm. we could go live from wherever we wanted, and we took advantage of it.
That's great. My guest today is Mike Binkley. This is Splashback Twin Cities. So you go to bed at 5 o'clock now, so there's not many hours left in the day here on Saturday. What beyond the news and your passion for news, what else do you like to do?
Well, my wife and I are big bikers. Mm-hmm. We're dog lovers, too. We have a dog, and we go on a lot of walks. We live in downtown Minneapolis now. We moved out of the suburbs when I got my job at WCCO, and we have bike trails everywhere. We can go from our downtown Minneapolis condo and hit a trail a block and a half away, basically, and we're never on city streets, or we can bike to the chain of lakes, you know, Minnehaha Creek, Lake Nokomis, Minnehaha Falls, you know, River Road, that sort of thing. Or, you know, sometimes we'll put our bikes on the car and drive up north and explore some new trails. So that's the big thing. You know, I like doing a little working out. You know, I work 9.5 hours a day, so you're right. You know, I get home, and there's not a lot of time left to wind down. But that's our big hobby, I would say, traveling and biking.
Bike to work?
I have, you know, but I'm going to work at 3 in the morning.
No, it's
and,
good,
you know,
point.
There's still enough, you know, shady characters out there. I've biked a few times. I've walked a couple of times. But, you know, you're out there basically on your own. And the one time last year we had a walk bike to work day, and I decided, okay, I'm going to set an example. I'm going to ride my bike to work. And I, you know, I chained it up outside the station and went to go home that day, and somebody had stolen it.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. And I, you know, I had locked it.
You have to use the city bikes, right? Is that the city bikes downtown?
The nice ride bikes? Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. They have those stations all over. Yeah. And there's one right outside my condo building. I could do that.
Well, there's options out there, but don't steal Mike Bingley's bike.
I know. I did get it back. Thanks to some very good police work, I did get it back. It ended up at a pawn shop.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's unfortunate.
Yeah. You know, you do have me curious. You are inundated by news all the time. Do you ever find yourself kind of just on autopilot throughout the day, or do you treat really every day as this is it, this is the big time?
No, I guess, you know, I can't be thinking that way every single day. I mean, I wish I could. I think that's probably the way I should be. But yeah, there are some times I try not to mail it in, so to speak. I try not to be on autopilot. I try and, you know, pay attention and focus on the details of every story. But I think there are certainly some times that the things get less attention than they should, just because of the just how big a workload it is over 2.5 hours.
Mm-hmm. Did you think you were going to be here as long as you have been?
No. You know, I feel very blessed to have been in this business for as long as I have. You know, so it was 20 years KSTP, 5 years in Cincinnati, 2 years in Topeka, Kansas, now 4.5 years here. So, you know, it's more than 30 years in the business, and a lot of people, this is a young person's business. Mm-hmm. It's kind of fun to be here as the old timer, kind of sharing stories. You know, I came up through the business kind of seeing myself as the kid, you know, but now being, you know, the senior reporter.
The seniority list gets shorter,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But it's fun, you know, and I look back and, you know, I've seen a lot of people come and go. So to have lasted this long, yeah, no, I do feel very blessed.
Well, I guess what I meant is when you came to Minneapolis, did you think this is my stop to Chicago or New York?
No.
Or no?
No, in this business, I mean, a lot of times you move around until you find a place that you're comfortable living in, and I absolutely love Minnesota. Married a Minnesotan. So, no, I never had ambitions to go to a larger market once, you know, I found the Twin Cities.
So you are a Minnesotan now. It's done deal.
I am a Minnesotan, yes.
That's great. No, I think, you know, there's sometimes Minnesotans have this idea of move-inners. You know, you come into town, and whenever they do the promo of the new anchor, I love Minnesota. My second cousin's best friend lived here. This is my big connection.
Yeah.
And then we don't see them, you know, a year or two later, and you've been in the business, you know, long enough. You see these guys come in and do that, and then they're gone. But it's great, and we've had a lot of people on Flashback Twin Cities here who came here not thinking this is going to be a lifetime job or a long-term job, but you adopt as your hometown. I think that when over half your life has lived in Minnesota, I think you can call yourself a Minnesotan. You're not a move-inner anymore.
No, good. Go.
What is your definition of becoming a Minnesotan? What was that moment? We talked about this before. What was the one thing you did where you're like, oh,
I'm a Minnesotan. I'm not a guy from Kansas visiting here.
You know, when I go back to Kansas now and talk, my family thinks that I sound northern. I think it's when I started pronouncing my O's, you know, a little more like, oh, I'm going to go outside, or my friend's got a boat. Yeah. You know, things like that. But I just the fact that I fell in love with this area, and I knew that I wanted this to be my home for the rest of my life. I think that was it.
Even though your garage flooded out during the superstorm, and you're here for a year, and we have World Series championships and these big storms, you must have thought this is one of the most exciting place ever.
This is it. This is where it happens. No, there are just a number of factors, but it is a pretty good news market. I mean, we're fortunate we don't have a lot of crime, which is what usually makes up newscasts and other areas. But we have enough colorful, you know, places, you know, beautiful places. That's my focus right now with all my reporting at WCCO is finding Minnesota. And I love telling the stories of Minnesotans and their traditions and the beautiful areas that we have.
We love hearing them. And your Twitter handle is?
Bink of America.
I like that. Bink of America.
That's pretty great.
Mike Binkley, WCCO TV, WCCO.com. Thanks for coming on today. It was great.
Oh,
and
great.
There's some great video of Mike Binkley on tcmedianow.com. This is Flashback Twin Cities. I am Tom Osmond. Myself and Thomas Hsu will be here next Saturday, 1 o'clock, with Lindsey Strand, of also Channel 5. Till then, we'll see you.